An interview with T. Alexander Pond, Executive Vice President and Chief Academic Officer, State University of New Jersey, Rutgers, in New Brunswick, in his office.
On Friday, December 18th.
87. In his office and at his home.
Are you on?
Yes, I'm on.
This is Thomas Alexander Pond. I came to Stony Brook. I'll recite my appointments after this. I came to Stony Brook in late July of 1962, except it was then Old Westbury. Long Island Center at Oyster Bay, and you can supply the exact date because it was about two or three working days before you arrived at Oyster Bay.
I arrived September 4th.
Well, then I misremember because I thought it was longer. I got there in July. Are you sure? I thought it was before that.
I was probably...
Did you visit there before you took up?
I may have.
Because I remember being summoned over while I was literally unpacking my briefcase with Bob Miriam to meet you. And you asked me why I had come. Well, first you asked Bob Miriam, the senior person present. And Bob said he came, I think it's Bob, I hope I'm not, it was a biologist, Bob or
yes,
something like that. Said he came because he didn't have to do a lot of teaching around here. I thought that was a rather stupid answer. So when you asked me, I told you that I hadn't been here long enough to decide.
I remember going out of that meeting with you and asking you when you had come. It turned out we both came the same.
Okay, I came at any rate into an appointment as professor of physics and chairman of the department.
Let me stop you for just a second. I have never known how much you people knew about me before I came, whether you had had any voice at all in or say in my coming.
I think I certainly hadn't, but that would be understandable because I had so recently arrived. But there was a saving your presence, a good deal of indignation floating around, and I'm quite sure I recall that part of that was some measure of absence of consultation.
I noticed that.
For example, had there been consultation, I expect I would have heard about it because I was in closest touch with the Department of Physics and with Fran Bonner in chemistry, and there was a name prior to yours, and I'm sure you know who that was. And he was gunned down, which I guess taught someone not to consult with the faculty. Not that it would have happened to you, but I don't know who it was.
I know that there was a man from Pennsylvania who was considered, and as I understood, did not take the job. That was Loren Isley.
I didn't hear about that. Of course, his name, he was nominated for every job everywhere in those periods. Some months prior to that, while I was still very much in St. Louis, but I guess I had decided to come, Oscar Lanford was brought forward.
That was after I was there.
No, Carl, it happened at least the first time before you were there.
Was he brought in twice?
If he came in after you were there, he came in twice. And I didn't hear about it the second time around.
Well, he came in after I had been there. We were brought in by Harry Porter, and we shot down by the faculty.
That happened before I got there.
Well,
the crucial observation that you made, there would have been a dreadful stink if that had been pressed, as you may have guessed. There was quite a serious statement of concerns.
Well, I don't know anything about that.
Ask Francis Bonner about it if you need first.
All right, it's good.
Because I never met the man until years later.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I may well have met his now famous son before I met him. Happy day.
Yeah.
I consider him to be one of the major disasters which overtook, major detailed disasters which overtook Sonny.
I'm glad it wasn't at Stony Brook.
Oh, it was. Stony Brook was very much part of the disaster. As a matter of fact, let me, I was down there last week, up there.
I know you were. And I was at it earlier, and I had to go out after the meeting.
And I at 7:30 Saturday morning in a driving rain, I took a quick trip around the campus, enormously depressing. But it struck me as I drove on, as it always does, how perfect Oscar's revenge on John Toll was. As you know, you may have noticed, the campus, of course, in our view, was very far from finished. And in particular, two of the structures at opposite ends of the campus were designed for expansion, the math building and administration building. They were concrete block walls intended to come out eventually, be the connection of both. Shortly after I was sacked, construction fund came along and bricked up those walls, finished brick. And then, just to drive...
On the east side of the administration building?
The Nickel Road side, yeah. East side, yeah. Then, shortly after that, just to drive a silver spike through the shade of John Toll, Oscar put that appalling parking structure on the intended site. And he even did it with non-matching brick. It is an absolute statement, and I can just see him cackling over the perfection of that revenge on a bunch of people that he surely must have hated as much as anyone in the world. The thing that rather bothered me, though, was that we had done all the politicking to get the money for the building, and but it was his shot by that time, and he sure fixed us. Fixed that campus forever. Irreparable. Piece of work. So, I came to Stony Brook, and I was professor of physics and chairman of the department. And that persisted for some time.
You had been at Washington University.
I was 37 years old at that time. I had come from associate professor of physics at Washington University. It's hard to say who was that was my initial appointment and persisted until 68.
Who brought you in?
I knew a number of people. The most direct connection was that Ed Lamb and I were in the same department at Washington University, and he went away from St. Louis mad a year before it turned out I had left St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty sure. I didn't tell you why I came to Stony Brook, nor did you ask me why I left Washington University. I was quite concerned that Washington University, while it's a wonderful little university, and it always has been just a splendid place, it's pretty clear to me that the world of physics was going to pass Washington University by,
mm-hmm.
and it did.
Mm-hmm.
It's done some wonderful things since then, but relative to the stature that it
Arthur Compton.
And under Arthur Compton,
yes.
And Arthur Hughes, it is, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I had been worrying for several years, I had been something of a leader in the junior faculty there, worrying about the future of the university. That put me in the frame of mind of thinking about the university that made me, it turns out, somewhat susceptible to the invitation from the people at Stony Brook to come and take the chairmanship of this very young, this non-department. The people who played a role in that, for virtually everybody in the department, I had long contact, not intimate, but had known of him and known him a bit with Leonard Eisenbud, the first chairman, since I was a student. Arnie Feingold was a graduate student ahead of me. Bob Zaffra was an undergraduate while I was a graduate student. It was, I must say, from the very instant that I sat down with them, it was the whole group that attracted me. Mm-hmm. It was really quite an extraordinary bunch.
Yeah.
And I think that's still clear in the character of the department.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
They were a Nelsonian band of brothers. I hesitate to claim that anyone was Nelson, but it was a very collegial place that cared intensely about what was happening. And let me record what was said several times last weekend, certainly by me too, that I think the most important day's work in all of Stony Brook was done before either of us was there. Was done, as so far as I can tell, by Sidney and by, critically, Arnie Feingold, who, as you know, was the dean of the graduate school for a while before they, I guess he quit when the dust-up occurred.
Yeah.
But in the aftermath of that trauma, when both sides were trying to figure out who had won, Arnie and Sid, and perhaps Fran, I don't know, got a hold of Porter or someone like that and said, what you must do to stabilize things is to authorize doctoral programs instantly. And physics got one. So that at the time I was talking with them, they were recruiting their first group of students.
That's,
the reason that that was absolutely critical was that it put the key argument into our hands in the formative years about the nature of what it was we needed.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out, of course, that the people we were talking to, while they, for at least a period, could not prevail against those arguments, had no earthly intention of there being a research university on Long Island.
Now, you're talking about the central office?
Yep, in a succession of chancellors. The difference between the Heald report and the first master plan was intended. It's a question that I bet you never pressed. I certainly never pressed because I didn't want to hear the answer.
Mm.
But the fact that they, to quiet the yattering of half the faculty at Stony Brook, they authorized that doctoral program, that was the ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the history of the place, when it's written, should find out when that was. It was during the immediate aftermath of the sacking of Lee, and it was a delegation. I think those were the three people. Maybe there was someone else along. Maybe Tom Irvine went along. I don't know. That was the day that the state of New York got put at serious risk of acquiring a major university on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it did not really feel it.
Well, that was either very late 61 or early 62.
Yeah. Well, it would have been the very earliest 62 because much into 62 it would not have been possible to recruit a graduate class. I have the flyer at home. I have about 8 copies of the flyer at home, which is, I think, a historic document.
You want to send me one?
I was looking for it just last week. I have a folder for the... My house is packed with papers. They're not organized. I will continue to look and send
you. All right.
They're very handsome, light gray and pink ink.
Mm-hmm.
Very clean. classy looking. You would have thought the place was some serious university rather than this fraudulent group in a dormitory. So all of those people were responsible. They got no help from anyone. There being no one there to help.
Porter came in just about that time.
Well, he was sort of commuting.
Yeah.
And I remember, I vaguely remember meeting with him. He, of course, was, at least in my dealings with him, was very inscrutable. Of course, he had a lot to be inscrutable about. I gather that, as you, I'm sure, have heard, I got to be somewhat comfortable with him later, and we had some very nice mm-hmm. discussions. But apparently, his assignment to Stony Brook was torture to him. He just had a terrible time, and my heart really does go out. I'm sure everybody was very mean to him.
I don't think that he and Tom Hamilton saw eye to eye very closely. And he's Harry was an historian by background.
Yeah.
And really a very gentle
yes.
kind of chap.
I think of him often.
Yeah.
I'm a gentle type of chap, even in spite of what I do from day to day.
Okay.
Who interviewed for the position here, that meaning Stony Brook?
Stony Brook, yeah. You've covered that.
Yeah, I came to the New York meeting in January 1962 and met with everybody in the department, and we came back out to Long Island, and I looked around, and the weather was miserable is what I mainly remember, but we began to develop plans at that point. What was your understanding? Oh, why did you come? What factors were most important in your decision? At that point in time, Sonny was a joke. You may remember it was pretty much a joke in the circles that I moved in. As for example, believe it or not, one of the few people. Few colleagues in St. Louis that I sought to talk about it with was Barry Commoner, who, believe it or not, I'm one of the few people who really likes Barry Commoner, the few people you'll ever meet. I admire his sense of systems and potential. I don't, scientifically, we're on different wavelengths, but he wouldn't even talk to me about it. He said it was a contemptible notion. It amuses me that Barry wound up at Queens. He is now retired from Queens. But at any rate, I mentioned one aspect that conditioned my thinking. It seemed to me that physics, which was the only thing I was interested in at that point, was at a crossroads. Academic physics was at a crossroads that, with the clear recognition now of the need to double the size of the higher education establishment, which had started in 58 with in the latter part of the Eisenhower administration and received very clear enunciation from Kennedy at the very beginning of his administration, that those states that had the biggest problem had a serious possibility of writing something new and very exciting. The research university business, and obviously New York was at that point the spectacular example a rich, sophisticated, needful state that had incredibly delayed its decision-making on how it was going to address the imperatives of public higher education. It seemed to me, in fact, I remember saying it,
Dewey had already taken the first step in 48.
But it was a non-step. By agreement of everybody, nothing would be done for 10 years. And, as I understand it, there was a secret codicil that nothing serious would be undertaken. The risks were obvious. The state had no record of accomplishment. Such institutions as it had were either, when they were good, they were trivial. When they were bad, they were very bad. public speeches that I gave on Long Island as I was summoned to a meeting of the New York Physical Society, New York chapter of the American Physical Society at Farmingdale, that high-flying academic institution that operated the little storefront down there, to give my plans for the department. And I gave them a very serious talk about how there were going to be 50 faculty and 300 graduate students, and the university was going to have between 10 and 20,000 students, that I was pressing for 20,000. And we were going to do the following things. And we were going to be big in high energy, and we were going to do nuclear physics. We were going to have a major strength in theoretical physics to complement Rickett. And they laughed. Mm-hmm. They laughed at me. Mm-hmm. Now, that was quite embarrassing, and that really wasn't my fault.
No.
But I must say I laughed since, because every word of it came true. Every damn word of it came true, and it came true in 5 years. Except for the 300, we never got over 130. But that's another story. We could have. It seemed to me, and I may have said to you, that when it became clear, as it was beginning to be clear by 1962, that Rockefeller was seriously intending to do this thing, and also had solutions for the obvious problems, namely the physical limitations. I then concluded it was going to happen. The plan was going to happen. And that in an enterprise of that magnitude, serious people burrowing away over in the corner, even if the whole organization was maligned, could probably get something done. I said that in those years as a joke. There was a little bit of prophecy in that, though.
Yeah.
But the attractions of Stony Brook, of course, are that at that point, where it is in the downstate part of the this wonderful state, it is in the under the full supervision of a very sophisticated region which knows what quality is, hasn't previously been interested in investing in it, but they damn well know what it is. That there would not be any risk of not being noticed.
Right, you were within hailing distance of Manhattan.
The New York Times is a very important object. And the New York Times doesn't give a rat's ass what's happening in Buffalo, but they sure care what's happening around them. I wish they cared a little more about what happens in New Jersey, but where we have some good news for them. But at any rate, it seemed to me that the state was indubitably going to move, that Rockefeller showed the direction in which the money could come from. It was not a matter of 10 sequential gambles on the legislature. He hocked the students so that he could build the place. Clever, clever idea. Just brilliant. Do you know whose idea that was? Did you ever hear? John Mitchell. Isn't that something?
Attorney General.
Yeah. His credits were in bond counseling. And he thought up the notion of the moral obligation bond and the political device of securing them with tuition, since the legislature would not fail to appropriate tuition assistance, but they might fail to appropriate buildings. Very clever. We're doing a bit of that down here.
Same thing.
Yeah, very quiet. Not nearly as grandiose. But at any rate, it was obviously a wild gamble. The other resources beyond the metropolitan region, having the metropolitan mandate, or the outside of city university, proximity to Brookhaven,
right,
profoundly important, as you recognized instantly.
Right.
And so it turned out. Which makes me feel especially badly that the university could not have been of more assistance to Brookhaven in their time of terminal grief. That they deserve better from us than they got. More smarts. That's, to me, acutely embarrassing, because they blessed and launched...
You mean, is Bell problem?
Yes. I think that's just a scandal, an indictment.
Did that happen after Johnny left or while he was still there?
It was beginning to happen while he was there. In fact, I remember Frank mentioning some concerns about them. But the need for political intervention couldn't be reasonably identified until 1980 or so, I think. About right now, I was worrying in 79.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, nothing was done about it. It has to be said that the initiation of the problem certainly was squarely attributable to Brookhaven, but greater shortcomings than that have been forgiven in this country. When people insisted that it happened. But that, I'm afraid, was a pretty profound signal to you all out there. And having enjoyed so many benefits from the support of Brookhaven, the university and Sonny and the state owes them a lot, and they never got it.
Mm-hmm.
And we over here, I was over here by the time the party got really rough, and I was signaling frantically, I can deliver you two senators, I can do lots of things for you, and no one asked. There was just no effort. The Northeast deserves everything that happened to it in that decade. Most annoying.
I didn't know really much about what was going on.
Well, it was... that's a symptom of the problem. You should have known all about it. You should have been writing your congressman, but no one told anyone.
But at any rate, let's see. Oh, yes, why did one go there? That was one reason. Also, I thought the location, quite beyond the proximity of Brookhaven, was an extraordinary advantage. It is a very beautiful area. It was clear it was then just beyond the reach of suburbia. It was clear that was going to break at about the same time as the university went in, and that one could envision a shockingly middle-class sort of environment for attracting faculty to. And that's terribly important. One could see the reminiscences of Palo Alto and Pasadena and San Marino and that sort of business, which I think in the case of Stanford, for example, was quite crucial to their success. It was not the only reason they prospered so mightily, but they grew in exactly the period when they grew in quality in exactly the period when that sort of extension of the conventional 50s notion of the good life was very important to faculty, and it was important to the people that we attracted, I think. You recall how worried you were about everybody living in New York. Well, they gradually decided this is the place to be, by and large.
Yeah. Prices have gone sky high, so that that's...
I resent that especially, I think. We sold out at the wrong time. Uh-huh. Fortunately, our investment here is appreciated, too.
Well, that's good.
Let's see. So, what other reasons? Well, as I say, I was taken. Arnie Feingold had a library of the key documents of the system from the late 50s and early 60s, and I was very greatly taken by the Heald Report. I thought that was an extraordinary document. I figured one could fake the differences between it and the 1960 master plan for as long as they didn't really raise the question up there.
New York has so many resources, in New York City particularly, in terms of highly intelligent, experienced individuals. But the university, until Wharton got his last commission going,
university didn't seem to be tapping them the way they should have.
I haven't seen that they seen any change in that. The city resources have been understandably continued to be a bit aloof as Stony Brook developed, simply because it was at that in those same years, and very late in the game, that they decided that City University had to become more of a public charge. But particular that, of course, is in any case an enormous resource. That just the people are in that. But the particular version of opportunity that I saw in the simultaneous development of a university, of an ambitious research university, in the midst of a developing region, I'm talking now about Nassau, was that's really very rare. You do not often see an opportunity for an institution to put its stamp on a region. Stanford came along a little bit behind the development of the peninsula, although they certainly managed to put a stamp on what happened afterwards. I thought that was an especially